like to just take a diversion here a little bit and ask one audience question. Is Michelle Huff here tonight? Michelle had a question that she sent in and said she would like to be here. So I'm not sure who'll want to answer this. She said, I would like to ask what it would take to develop a rational, statewide higher education system with a single Board of Regents and eliminate much of the duplication and waste associated with the current decentralized system of governance.
I think the chancellor should take it.
So President Abdallah said too easy, it's softball.
The answer very simply is political courage, and you don't have it.
Not me personally? Or
no. There you go.
I'm just a purveyor of bad news.
In the state, there's insufficient political courage to make the structural changes that would be required to achieve what your friend asked in her question.
And I will add on that, because it would take constitutional legislative changes, right, as I pointed out earlier. But the assumption in that question is that one board is the answer. And what I want to stress is we don't know that. There are 50 experiments going on right now in this country about how higher ed should be structured. Every state essentially has a different system. There is no one answer out there. They're all structured differently. And many of those who are decentralized like us and became one, guess what they're doing now? Decentralizing. So we in New Mexico have to find that sweet spot. And when you give me some more time, I'll tell you how we're getting to that.
Well, I thought it would be a thought-provoking question.
That's too easy.
But, you know, I think we were talking earlier that the state of Georgia just went through a consolidation and has not been particularly impressed with its results at this point. But she did use the word rational here as well. Yeah. But I think
she's a lawyer.
She could very well be. I do think a couple things that we did hear from our legislators is I think Senator Smith addressed sort of the notion that we underfund higher education. And I think he did point out that we are ranked second nationally in per capita funding of higher education, and that the amount of our state budget that goes to higher education exceeds the average by, I think, he said almost double.
Twice.
So I think those points are points that probably shouldn't get lost in this discussion. So I'd like to go now to President Abdallah, whom I've had the pleasure of having any number of theoretical discussions about all this with, and I'm not sure when he's pulling my leg, and I'm not smart enough to figure out when he's kidding. But we'd like to hear your thoughts on this. And before this, you and I were talking about the changes, and they go to online, they go to everything, and I think we were talking about how aggressive Arizona State University has been marketing their online degree as indistinguishable from their conventional degree. And as I understand it, Starbucks has reached an agreement with them that they will do tuition support for any student anywhere, any employee anywhere in the country who wants to do ASU online, as long as they're outside of Phoenix. So the competition is just ratcheted up at almost the same pace as President Shepard talking about the iPhone, which is a fairly recent development. So how do we adapt here? How do you, what do you see? You told me once we need a plan.
Thank you. First, I want to thank the journal and the audience tonight for being here to listen to us on a panel on higher education. I doubt we would have had that many people if we were talking about UNM athletics. So thank you so much. I do appreciate it very much. And just as a nod to my colleagues here, you know, the Harvard and the Yale, you know, we like to think of Harvard as the UNM on the Charles River and of Yale as the UNM in New Haven. So just but thank you. Thank you for that. Before I get into it, I want to go back a little bit or maybe step up a little bit and talk about theoretically, why do universities exist? What do they do? And how do they do it? And I think once you answer those questions, I think you'll be able to discuss who should be paying and how do we finance them. So let me start, why do they exist? If I go around the room now and I ask, why should a university exist? What's a university for? I'll bet you I'll get, what do we have, 80 people? I'll bet you we'll probably get 80 different answers. And here's what I mean. You know, to the parents, to some of the students, the universities exist for a particular reason. To the parents, maybe to house the kids for 4 or 5 years so that they mature. But in many cases, because they want them to get jobs eventually, some of them. To society, to outside people, maybe it's because they want to educate the whole person. They want citizens who know how to vote, who don't get in trouble, who don't go to jail, and so on. If you talk to companies want them to do one thing, you know, and I appreciate the nod to the iPhone and so on. But you know, we used to have a company here that was one of the biggest employers, Intel. And when they decided that it doesn't make sense anymore, Intel is no longer the biggest company in here. They're still here and they're investing in some things. But the point I'm trying to make is that depending on who you ask, why should the university exist? Why do you go to university? You get different answers. So you keep that in mind when you say the university should do X, because it's not obvious or it's not agreed upon that the university should be doing one thing. The next thing is, what should the university do? And even if we had an agreed upon mission, if we decided the universities exist to educate kids, students, then what should that education cover? Should it be the liberal arts? Should it be a T model, like people say, broad yet deep in one area? Should they protect the students? You know, a lot of discussions these days are about what the students are encountering on campuses. What about free speech? What about having them having nice facilities, as President Shepard mentioned? What about that? Is that something that the university should be into? Should the universities provide entertainment? Should we have a football team? Should we have an orchestra? Are those things important if we decide that it's about education? How do we do it is the next question. How do we do it? Well, we do it in different fashions. In some cases, we decide we're going to put 800 kids in one room. In others, we decide it's one-on-one. I have one of my faculty here who teaches music, one-on-one. We have part-time instructors. We have them online. We have people face-to-face. We have flipped classrooms and so on. If you answer these questions, and according to what you answer them, then you decide, well, who should be paying for this? Because as many people have already described, the state of New Mexico is generous. The taxpayer of New Mexico is generous in funding higher education. 13% of the budget goes to higher education. Now, that's way down from what it used to be. Way down from what it used to be, but it's still more than double. I think Wyoming is the only one ahead of us. But once they get to how much gets to each student, and once you add the tuition to that, which is the important number, because as far as the universities are concerned, the cost of delivering education, it doesn't matter if the state paid or if the students paid. At the end of the day, it costs about $15,000 approximately. If the state pays $15,000, the students can afford to pay zero. So that's key. It's the total amount. And that one, we're not in the top half. In fact, until very recently, we were very low. It's good to keep our tuition low. But when you discuss how generous the state is, you got to look at it also from how much of that filters down to where the dollars are being spent. Now, to complicate the matter further, it's not just about what the university does, but the type of students. And we can no longer speak about a student or our students. We have, according to a recent study, about 7 different types of students. We have the traditional, and the traditional students, you're right, they want to be on campus, they want nice facilities. They need advising. Many of them come to us, they're not ready to do college work. And then we have the military people that you mentioned, somebody who doesn't need any advising, or he doesn't need the same type of advising. They don't need the facilities on campus. They need the infrastructure that President Shepard mentioned. We have others who are career switchers. They're switching careers. They want to take 3 or 4 courses. Each one of those segments will need different support systems, different type of university, or different services provided by the university. So how does that relate to UNM? Well, let me tell you about what we did at UNM and then maybe look forward. So we ask why. Why do we want to do something? At the time when I became provost, we decided that we wanted to do is reduce failure and we wanted to maximize the quality. What I mean by that is, it doesn't matter how many students you get in if you're losing a lot of them. It's much, much better, much more efficient. Once you get them in the door, to keep them and to graduate them. So we worked on that. What did we do exactly? Well, we focused on reducing the leakage and we reduced the cost of delivery while maintaining the quality, because at the end of the day, we can be very efficient, but very ineffective. We can be very efficient if we don't spend a lot of money on something, but then if we're losing them. In fact, we had that experiment at the University of New Mexico. In 2010, we had our largest incoming class ever. That was our worst performing class because we didn't have the support system for them. So we lost a lot more of those kids after a year. And that's the worst thing we can do, is get them in, and then after a year, they leave with some debt or they leave with no credential. That's the worst. That's worse than not letting them in the door. How did we do it? Well, we focused and engaged everyone. This was an effort that started by getting the faculty involved, getting the staff, getting the administration messages, and so on and so forth. And we invested in data analytics. We knew where the bottlenecks were, and we went into and invested in those. The results were reduced dropouts. We actually increased graduation rates and the number of degrees. In fact, we doubled our four-year graduation rate. We did it in faster time than any university in this nation. In 4 years, we doubled the four-year graduation rate. We are at a record in the six-year graduation rate. The five-year graduation rate is close to a record. At the same time, we got ranked recently as the third in the U.S. in the improvement in critical thinking in what our students do. So it's not what they end up with; it's what the difference between what they came up, what they came in, and what they left with. Each year, we reduce in the time it takes to a degree. Each year is about $60,000, about $20,000 for the cost of attendance, and about $40,000 in salary. So $60,000, if we cut 1 year from somebody's stay at the university, if they're going full-time. Now, we are also doing a lot of the stuff that the chancellor mentioned about re-engineering the universities. In fact, we did centralize finance. We did do the same with IT and simplify processes, but we are launching a major effort to try to re-engineer the university, every single process and entity at the university, exactly because we feel that this is not passing. This is really the new reality, the new normal. The question was also posed, should we be a system? You know, it was asked in some of the questions that we got from the journal, from the moderator. Well, so it so happens I'm a systems engineer. That's my degree. That's what I did before I became an administrator. So I tried to cast very complex problems into systems. And systems, basically, if you have nothing tonight, anything that you learn from me or you get from me, this is something you can take and use it on every problem you have. Systems are a box with inputs and outputs. You have to define your inputs. You have to define your outputs. But there is something else. Within the system, there's something called the state of the system. I'll give you an example. Your car. Your car is a system. Your inputs are your steering and you're stepping on the gas or on the brake. Those are your inputs, the things you have control over. Your outputs is your speed. It could be your fuel consumption and so on. But the state of the system is what you cannot measure. That's everything that's happening inside. You cannot measure the state in general. Very complex systems, you cannot measure the state. So within the university, our inputs, they come from high schools. They come from society. The easiest way to raise our graduation rate is to accept a lot less students. In fact, we can do, at the University of New Mexico, we have the data analytics to show you that if you want me to graduate 90% of our students, or you give me a number, then we'll be able to do that by only accepting those students who have the characteristics to succeed without doing anything at the university, anything different. The other part of the problem or the other part of the system is the outputs. If there are no jobs, if the society and the economy is not absorbing those degrees, then what use is it to graduate a lot more engineers in the state of New Mexico? We do graduate a lot of engineers, by the way, in the state of New Mexico. A lot of them leave the state. So that has to be the other part. What I'm trying to tell you is the system doesn't exist by itself. It exists within a bigger system or the society. Now, should we be a system as a state? Should we have a system? I think the secretary mentioned that there is an effort we're undergoing in here that we're trying to discuss. But before somebody jumps to conclusion, there is a statement I like to quote here: is for every complex problem, there's an answer that's clear, that's simple, and that's wrong. Okay. So before we jump to that, let's not get into it. Now, the other part of this is that the university is very decoupled, but the state, as you just heard from the chancellor, it's a very, very decoupled and very difficult thing. And as one of my friends told me one time, is that at the university, change is hard, and it's easier to change the course of history than to change a history course at the university. Now the secretary proved us wrong on this. We changed a lot of courses, but so what I would suggest is first we spend more time defining the problem than solving it. You know, do no harm. Start with you know, cautionary. Do no harm. Knowing it's very difficult. You know, Woodrow Wilson again. He was before he became president of the United States. He was president of the university, Princeton. And he said, how can I democratize this university if the faculty won't do what I say? And that's, you know, that's to my faculty, but that's also to everybody else. I do want to close with something because I think sometimes we lose the big picture. And a couple of years ago, I was asked to speak at the opening of a symposium at the University of New Mexico. And the title of it was What Use is History? And it was funded by the Mellon Foundation to try to train or teach historians to have other jobs beyond history or not look just into academic careers. And I just want to close with what I told them, because I think it's very relevant. I started by saying, if by use you mean utility, then what use is a newborn child? And if by use you mean usefulness, then what use is a Georgia O'Keeffe painting? What use are the sage words of a grandmother or the kiss of a mother? At a time where utility and usefulness are the only measures of college education, what good indeed is history education? And I think keep that in mind as we try to proceed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's go to Chris Brown and get a faculty perspective to everything you've heard here tonight. Feel free to weigh in on any comment by anyone and tell us what it's like to be in your kind of position in this kind of system facing these kinds of challenges.
No pressure at all, right? Just deliver.
None. Yeah.
Thank you for the opportunity to participate in this panel that examines the considerable challenges facing higher education in New Mexico. I appreciate the work that the Albuquerque Journal and Council on University Presidents teams did in putting this panel together and the chance to be part of the discussion. I have to admit to being a bit unsettled up here. These are really, really smart people. And when I told my 12-year-old daughter that the chancellor was going to fly me up to Albuquerque in the plane, which he did, so I could participate, she looked at me, she said, why did they ask you to join them? So who better to answer a 12-year-old's question than I'll let my boss answer it. When Chancellor Carruthers asked me to join you, he noted he wanted a faculty perspective to be included in the discussions we have tonight, how best to meet the challenges we face. As chair of the Faculty Senate at NMSU, I share with you my perspective on two concepts that I think state and university leadership needs to keep in mind in crafting solutions to the challenges. These two concepts are the commitment to the project that most faculty members make and the concept of shared governance my boss took from me a few moments ago. Most faculty members make long-term commitments to the universities and colleges where they work. The tenure process provides department heads and deans the opportunity to ensure faculty are doing their jobs. Many faculty that achieve tenure then build upon this beginning to their career over years, even decades, to advance the three charges we are given as faculty members. The first of these charges is teaching. As teachers, our job is both straightforward and challenging. To help students gain mastery of the things they study. That's our job. This mastery then allows students to be informed members of society, to make a living so they can provide for their families, and to help meet the challenges that face New Mexico or other places they will call home. Our next charge is research. Many faculty and most that work at our four-year universities are charged to conduct research, to work with colleagues in the process of discovery, and to share these discoveries with colleagues in society. The last, but by no means the least important of these charges, is to serve. Service takes many forms, but the gist of this work is to share our knowledge and discoveries to help meet the needs of the communities where we live, the universities where we work, and ultimately, the citizens of New Mexico that pay our salaries. As discussions unfold on how to best meet these challenges, I ask that decision makers at the university and in state government keep in mind the commitment that most faculty make to their institutions and be aware of the knowledge and perspective they bring to the discussion. I now would like to make a few comments about my perspective of shared governance, and I have to ride home with him on the plane. As chair of the NMSU Faculty Senate, I have visited our community colleges and shared my view of this important principle by which our university should be run. I refer to it as my shared governance roadshow. So, what is shared governance in a university context? Put simply, it's the sharing of the power and the ability to make decisions among faculty, staff, and administrators. And as importantly, the sharing of the responsibility that making these decisions entails. I'm very fortunate to work with a senior leadership team at NMSU where Chancellor Carruthers and Provost Howard see the value of this principle. In numerous ways, they invite faculty and staff to the table to discuss the many issues we face, and we then work together to help the university meet its mission. At times, shared governance is a bit messy and time-consuming. Quite honestly, at times, it's a major headache. That said, I feel very strongly that this is a necessary principle in how universities are run, and I invite people working to solve the challenges that higher education in New Mexico faces to include this principle in your work. I'd like to close with my comments with a few words about an effort by which people at NMSU are building on the commitment faculty make to the institution, working through shared governance to address the budgetary challenges we face. Chancellor Carruthers shared with you the transformation project and the six teams that we've undertaken at NMSU. Currently, team six, we're examining how the academic side of the house can be restructured to make us more efficient and effective at the work we do. Although the chancellor didn't refer to it directly, it's built on the principle of shared governance. Over half the members are faculty members and department heads. The team also includes staff, some members of central administration, and some deans. Meeting materials and outcomes of our discussions are shared openly with the NMSU community. Put simply, this is a wide tent that operates as an open book as we explore some very challenging issues. I can do this. I can do this.
You're still going?
Sorry?
You're still going? I don't want to interrupt you.
I'm almost there. Remember, they're smarter than me, so I need more time. In our work, we're examining three related but distinct issues: the role and challenges of small departments. How can these departments best meet their challenges and fulfill their roles? The stipends and other compensation that heads earn to run their shops. Is the current system equitable and fair? Is it effective and is it efficient? And lastly, the structure of the different pieces of the academic side of the house. Could the various colleges and departments be realigned, restructured, or both to be more effective at carrying out their charge to teach, to do research, and to serve the many groups we serve? We're 6 months into the process. We have a pretty good handle on the questions involved, and we're trying to figure out the answers that we need to help this move forward. We just offer this as a model that other institutions may wish to examine as they have similar discussions. Before Mr. Waltz stands up again, thank you for your time. I look forward to any discussion or questions that my comments generate. It'll be an interesting ride home in the plane.
You're welcome, and good luck on that plane trip. Did you carry parachutes?
No. Okay. No, we take adult beverages along so we can share on the way back.
Excellent. Just for context for our audience, just real quickly, I'd like to ask each of the presidents here and our two presidents in the audience, what is your current enrollment and what does that include? We talked about dual credits. And can you break it down between traditional and online?
I can't do the difference between traditional and online, but we pretty much count our enrollment as a system. We have four community colleges in the main campus. Main campus will be somewhere between 14 and 15,000 students, and the community college will be another 10,000 students. Most of the dual credit courses are actually taught by the community colleges. Online, we're not as strong online as Western and perhaps others. We've been kind of late to the party, and so it's not a big number.
President Shepard?
We have 3,500 students. However, to define online is difficult because many of our on-campus students are taking online without ever going to class but living in the dormitory. So to separate out that out is rather difficult. About 2,000 students live or are at the Silver City site. We just closed down two sites, one in Gallup and one in Lordsburg, simply because the online in Gallup surpassed the in-person and no longer became economical for us, and to save money of about $500,000, we closed that site without damaging the four credit that people are taking in Gallup. And Lordsburg was the same, and over in Truth or Consequences, we're doing something similar. And the other place that we have students is over in Deming. Senator John Arthur Smith mentioned that a little bit, about 500 students there.
So really, we often think of online as distance learning, but the concept there, that's just not true. So yeah. You have students actually living in Silver City, living in the dorms, right, and never actually going to class in the buildings.
That's
they're doing
correct.
It online.
Right.
So we have 27,000 in Albuquerque, and we have four branches. About the two big ones are about 3,000, 2,000, and then less than 1,000 for the others. Of those, we have about 12,000 students who are taking online. About 4,000 are exclusively online, meaning we don't see them. But about 12,000, and those include the students you mentioned, the people who are in their dorm rooms or somewhere else where they don't want to come to class at that time, or they don't want to dress up to go to class.
And how does that work for those students?
So for us, the model is that we charge an online fee above and beyond. So online costs a little bit more. People pay for the convenience. We had a proposal last year, and we're trying to figure out a way to pass it by, to try to, rather than charging those students who are taking online, who are paying for the infrastructure, is to have everybody pay for it and reduce it on the online. Because, you know, the online system, the system that we use, you know, to deliver the courses, is actually being used by people who are even in the classroom because the material is online and so on. So we feel it's better to try to distribute the cost.
How do you handle the cost, President Shepard?
We handle it the same way. We're, there's an online course fee above tuition, so there's a slightly higher price being paid by the online students.
And how does that work for in-state, out-of-state students? Everybody in-state for those purposes?
That purpose is the same way. So let's say you're from Massachusetts, you're taking one of our online courses. You'd pay out-of-state tuition, and then you'd also pay the online course fee. Let's say you're from Massachusetts and you go to Silver City and take the course. You won't pay the online fee, but you'll still pay the out-of-state tuition.
So that's the same thing, but we are looking at a model where the online is not, you know, it'll be the same cost for everybody.
Why would I pay out-of-state tuition to take an online course at Western when I can take a course at ASU
because we're still cheaper.
I'm in-state.
We're still cheaper, even with the out-of-state.
Even with the out-of-state tuition.
In many cases, we are still cheaper than some of the others, in many cases.
That's the same as true. In fact, we have a number of our students from New York, and when we tell them what their out-of-state tuition is to do the social work program, which is one of the top rated in the nation, they still think they're getting a great deal compared to their in-state tuition.
And that is what that naval officer's degree was in, social work, now that I remember. Dr. Winograd, what is your enrollment? What is your online component, or do you have one?
We have the largest online presence in the state at CNM. We have about 40,000 people that we serve every year. 25,000 of that is credit students. The rest are non-credit students that take advantage of our things like our boot camps. and we serve around 4,000 dual credit students. We have an incredible relationship with APS and have a high school on our campus. It's the only high school in the state of New Mexico that got all A's in its ratings, so we're very proud of that. What else do I need to tell you? I would say our biggest growth at the college, like most others at this table, has been in online, and we're putting a lot of energy into that.
So what is the demographic age of your student population?
Our average age is about 28, and we are a minority-majority institution. We celebrated this year having the largest number of Hispanic graduates in the country and the largest number of Native American students graduate in the country, and we're the second largest in terms of graduation of all the community colleges in the country, and yet we are about the 57th in terms of size.
So you heard our legislators talk about the role of the two-year community colleges, and can you talk a little bit about how you think this fits in and what your vision is and how the system works and your CNM's place in it? And
way
what
to make me go last and then make it a big question, Kent. I don't get that. I am truly thrilled to be here tonight and very honored to be here with my colleagues at this table. But I do feel a sense of responsibility because I am representing a sector of higher education that serves 57% of the enrollment in New Mexico of our public higher education students. And as a result of that, I want to sort of remind you that community colleges do have a different mission and a different vision for what we do. And very quickly, I would just say that we are the institutions that provide a very caring approach to entering higher education. We have programs and faculty and staff that help students be successful through programs and small classes. And we find that it is our responsibility to make sure that students are not only successful with us, but successful in their next step. So we are very proud that our students do well when they transfer to universities. And we are also incredibly connected to our workforce development and economic development goals in each of our communities. And that mission makes us very committed to being agile and flexible and constantly focusing on what we need to do to be able to lift our communities up and change the lives of our students. Community colleges across the state have dealt with financial issues differently, so I can only talk about what we have done at CNM, but in 2008, we started our restructuring process. We started by reducing our administrative overhead. We took two vice presidents off the books, as well as 24 senior level administrators, and began our restructuring with that. We have done three different phases since 2008, and those phases have included the kinds of things that you've heard here tonight: consolidation of programs, reduction of overhead, but we've also focused on things like sustainability and making sure that we are doing the kinds of things that help us save money around our use of water and our use of electricity and the kinds of things that really provide an opportunity for us to be a good neighbor as well as to be efficient and effective. But more importantly to me is not what we did to save money, but what we did to focus our institution in a different direction in terms of trying to meet the needs of our economic development partners and our workforce partners by being innovative and creative around creating another revenue source for the college. So our Ingenuity Inc. is a great opportunity for us to do things like the coding and cybersecurity boot camps, our makerspace that we're very excited about opening with Innovate Albuquerque, our there are five small businesses running out of that. So not only are we providing an opportunity for training, but we are also creating a workforce in our central New Mexico area. We are dealing with apprenticeship programs, and we just did our first spinoff of the Ingenuity Software Labs, and we are really looking forward to learning from that opportunity so that we can spin off other companies. And these are unique and wonderful things for community colleges to be able to do. We also are incredibly proud about the partnerships that we have built. My colleagues at this table all have been great partners for CNM. We have an online program with Western. We've have New Mexico State on one of our campuses, and we're really excited about that. And of course, the University of New Mexico and CNM have been long-term partners, creating relationships where students can go back and forth. We have probably about 5,000 students that we call our swirls who take classes at both UNM and CNM at the same time. So much of our discussion tonight has been focused on issues of higher education, the crisis around low enrollment and declining budgets and our lottery scholarship. But I want to say that I'm equally concerned about the crisis we're facing in our state, the low number of citizens in New Mexico that have degrees, and it's actually decreased since 2010 by 4%. The brain drain that keeps getting worse in New Mexico, one of the pieces of data, although a little bit old, said that in 2015, 41% of the people leaving New Mexico had bachelor's degrees or higher, and that's worrisome to me. The significant population of individuals 16 through 24 who are neither in school nor in the workforce, we're the largest in the United States in that category. And the constant worry that I am truly worried about all the time, and that's how do we make sure we have a workforce for this community as we go forward. So are there too many higher education institutions in New Mexico? Yes is just too simple. And no is just too simple. The my belief, and I will own this, is that we have significant things that we need to consider as we move forward. The state has made a large commitment in terms of buildings and equipment over the years to higher education, and we need to make sure that we are capitalizing on that commitment that has been made and the investment the state has made. Each of the campuses shares a special relationship with its community, and we need to take that into consideration as we're thinking about what we do in the future. I think that we should also really focus on better effectiveness, better efficiencies, more cohesiveness. I truly believe there's lots of ways for us to come together, but I also think we need to really focus on innovation. You've heard us talk tonight about technology and how we use that. There are so many ways that we could create a different system of higher education, the kind of system that makes us all excited. We talked about companies changing, the world changing, so should higher education. And I think if we use the investment that we've made and build on it, that would be a positive thing. I want to thank everybody tonight for being here, and certainly for our sponsors for having this discussion and focusing on the higher education crisis. I do believe our challenges are great, but we face the possibility of a much larger catastrophe if we forget how important higher education is to the economy and social health of our state. So I'm going to end by saying that I'm in my 21st year at CNM and my 11th year as president. And I don't think one week has gone by that I haven't been involved in a conversation where people in New Mexico are talking about what if, what if? So not only is this the land of enchantment, this is also the land of dreams. So my question to you tonight is, what if we actually asked this question differently and created the kind of higher education structure that would be looked at by other states, the kind of higher education system where people would want to imitate us? So thank you.
Thank you. I'd like briefly to ask President Bailey and President Wells if you'd like to come up here and come on up so you can have this microphone.
Hi, everybody. Thank you, by the way, sir. Hi, everyone. I'm Rick Bailey, president of Northern New Mexico College. I'll make it very quick because I know it's 8:45. Let me say a couple things. One, we are public institutions. We recognize that. So I think the spirit behind this discussion, we take it very seriously. The members of the Council of Universities Presidents have spent the last 2 days looking and fighting for ways for us to be more efficient. We're trying to innovate and, hey, are there ways in which we can collaborate in things like software licensing sharing and IT support and Banner and you name it. So we're fighting already for ways, and we owe that to you as taxpayers. Secondly, I want to talk about return on investment. And the best way I can say that is by sharing a little story about, a very quick story, about an individual who just graduated from Northern. That individual, non-traditional student, mid-20s, came off the path early, minimum wage job, started a family, a couple of children, and then decided that that wasn't good enough. And that individual worked his tail off at Northern, graduated in May, and just started a job making $85,000 a year. And for those of you who don't know the Espanola Valley, take it from me, that's a lot of money in Northern New Mexico. Here's my point. My point is this educational journey wasn't just a return on investment for that individual. And it wasn't just a return on investment for that family, it was a return on investment for that whole community because that individual is staying in the Espanola Valley. And the fact that that family income just quadrupled means more money that's going to local businesses and shops and real estate and taxes and everything else. So I think as a state, as we have this discussion, let us think about higher education as an investment that helps everybody. The rising tide that can lift all boats. Lastly, Secretary Damron talked about access as one of the strengths of our system here of our many systems here in New Mexico. I couldn't agree more. Access to quality, affordable higher education should not just be reserved for students who live near big cities. As we have this discussion, let us fight by all means to make sure that students and opportunities for students are at the heart of that discussion. I think we owe that to the state of New Mexico, because at the end of the day, what our institutions are providing isn't just educational. It can be transformative, and that's something worth protecting. Thanks.
Thanks, Rick, and thank you for the opportunity and to my colleagues for their statements. I think it's right on the mark. Let me just add that New Mexico Tech doesn't have any branch campuses. I'm very proud of that. I don't have an athletic program. I'm very proud of that. Sorry, Chucky Gal. And I know that Senator Smith keeps trying to give me one, but that's not going to happen. We have about 2,150 students, but it's different in terms of online education there. Many students come to Tech because we offer a ratio of about 14 to 15 students per faculty member. They want that hands-on capability, especially in the science and engineering area. So there is a difference with each institution in terms of their culture and what students are seeking, and we attract some of the brightest students here in the state. I also believe that part of our responsibility in higher education, I came from Nevada where we had 17 years of experience in this, is building economic diversification for this state. You have not leveraged higher education as much as you could to to help this state. And that takes courage, that takes support. So like my colleague, President Bailey, many of our students go on to do remarkable things. The vice president of Microsoft, who developed the Xbox, is a graduate from Tech. We need those people to stay here, but we have to have the companies. And so I also feel an obligation as a president not to depend on tuition or the state as much as I need to, but look for new ways of developing revenue sources. So like my colleagues, and they've done a great job at State and UNM, we're building commercialization efforts so that we can spin off innovations and derive revenue from that. I'm reaching out to alumni, asking for them to support. We have an online calculus prep course for students who aren't ready to start, because calculus is our beginning math course. That's paid for by an alum. They cover the cost. And so I feel an obligation to the state to look for other sources of money to help us as we move forward and grow at New Mexico Tech. So I want to thank you for the opportunity, but my final statement is leverage us. Leverage us for economic development. Have a statewide economic plan that we can all rally around, and then leverage higher education to build the companies so our students stay here. Thank you very much.
Thank you both very much. I've heard a lot of great stories talking to you privately and tonight, and I think one of the ones that really illustrates how all this industry, I guess we can call it an industry, this enterprise has changed. One was your naval officer, call it what? Cult. Well, but I thought that Chowkee, your story about the student you had from Afghanistan was interesting. We have just a couple minutes left. I wonder if you could just share that just as an insight to how different this world is that we're in now.
So to illustrate the type of students we have and we're serving, I teach a graduate class on system theory, and one time I had this student in, who was registered online, and you know I'm communicating with him, and he told me because of the timing or something, and he said, well, I'm stationed in Afghanistan. You know, he's from, our base, Air Force base, but I'm stationed in Afghanistan, and he did well, and he didn't need a lot of help. Obviously, he's dealing with matters of life and death, so this was probably a diversion for him. Anyway. Did well in that class, and then later another semester he was registered in another class of mine, and I said, hey, how you doing? How's Afghanistan? He said, no, I'm in Albuquerque. I said, why are you online? He said, well, it's better. It's easier for me. I can, I stay in here. I don't have to park and so on and so forth. So the thing is, they're really doing a lot more, for even to illustrate the point about the students are also voting with their feet on some of these. Now, of course, I'm a great teacher online. That's one of the reasons. Otherwise, he wouldn't be doing. But.
Not in person, though. Just
not so much in person. No. A lot better on the radio.
I would all briefly like to acknowledge Kathy Winograd and President Abdallah are both important members of this Vision Council of Mission Graduate, which is a United Way endeavor to increase the number of degrees in our community by 60,000. An ambitious goal that. We'll see. But it just unveiled a major new initiative last week. And I think maybe I'd ask Dr. Winograd to talk a little bit about that, because a lot of that has to do with what you're doing.
I think the program Kent is referring to is called Graduate Albuquerque. And it is an effort for us to recognize that a number of citizens in our area who are adults have no credential in higher education, and that we need to be able to reach out to that population of students and help them by providing them what Angelo Gonzalez refers to as a soft handoff, so that we can counsel them into both UNM and CNM in a way that allows them to get that credential, improve their life. Rising of the tide that we're all hoping for in our community.
Thank you. Before we're going to close by just doing maybe a minute each for your takeaway or your words of wisdom that you want to share. But before I do that, I want to acknowledge State Treasurer Tim Eichenberg is here with us tonight. Tim, are you back there? Hello. Former State Treasurer James Lewis, and recently stepped down as President of the UNM Alumni Association. APS Board Member Peggy Mueller, Aragon, are you here somewhere? Hi, Peggy. I'm sure I missed other people, but I wanted to, somebody pointed somewhere. Anyway, I just wanted to make sure that I, Angela, are you back there? Kathy just gave you a plug, so good. So we have just 5 or 6 minutes left before they do that radio signal. But I just wanted to, we've heard some interesting things. We've heard about the monetary challenges. There isn't going to be a bunch more state money. I think that's pretty clear from the comments from Senator Smith and Representative Larrañaga. It isn't there. It's not going to happen. I've heard some people talk about we need to be more entrepreneurial in our own enterprises. We've heard people talk about we need to be more efficient in our own enterprises. We've heard people talk about how we need to be more competitive in our enterprises, because that's how we're going to get the students to walk in and vote with their feet and their parents' checkbook or their checkbook. But with that, I'd just like to start with Secretary Dameron, and we'll just kind of go down and just give us briefly your takeaway from this.
Briefly, and by the way, some of these had 30-second notices 5 times. I obeyed mine the first time. Brief, the time is now for higher education. You've heard the challenges we have here, but you've also heard how we're already coming together in a number of ways. We are monopolizing that because higher ed is in a different place than it's ever been. It's an exciting time to be in higher education because the world is ours here in New Mexico. We are coming together through NMSHM, the New Mexico Statewide Higher Education Master Plan. Everyone here is involved with this. We have committees that are looking at what is going to be best for our state. How should it be structured? What is the best governance model for us? What are the financial implications for that? And what is it going to take to have any legislative and constitutional changes with that? So it is very exciting because, as has been said, as the states are the laboratories of democracy, the systems of higher education institutes are the laboratories of higher education governance. Everything we do, all of us here in this room who are involved in higher education, look through the eyes what is best for our students here in New Mexico, and we all pledge to you our commitment to that going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Chancellor Carruthers?
A couple of comments. Many years ago, the business community took it upon themselves to begin to work on reforming public education. And so we put a lot of energy into it, and there were some statutes passed at Santa Fe that would be considered rather remarkable, the level of tier teaching levels with higher salaries for teachers, and some of the things were accomplished. And I was talking to Senator Smith, and he said, where is your business community in higher education? You know, you seem to have participated in public education. Where is the business community in higher education? And my thought was, you know, we need to invite them to join us. As a matter of fact, recently I had some business people come and talk to our regions, but we need, as higher education, to better energize our business community to talk about higher education, and when we need their assistance, whether it's on the campus or in the legislature, we need to do that. And the other point I would make is all universities and all community colleges have discovered in the last 10 or 15 years, in the last analysis in New Mexico, it's all about developing entrepreneurs and a world-class workforce. If we just develop entrepreneurs and a world-class workforce, New Mexico will be fine.
Thank you. President Shepard.
You know, one thing that's oftentimes lost is we want a quick fix. There are no quick fixes for this. This is kind of like your retirement. You start years and years in advance. You don't wait till you're 65. That's what we're doing right now. We're planting the tree for tomorrow's student. But we need to stay relevant. We need to find other funding sources because the state's not going to be it. We're going from state-supported to state-assisted to state-located. And that's what's happening in higher education. But I also encourage you to understand that universities aren't simply about educating a student to get a degree. They're also cultural centers. And we should not forget what it means to communities like Silver City and beyond in terms of those particular communities. And we should never throw the baby out with the bathwater.
President Abdallah?
President Shepard really stole my 2 lines. So first, I do want to focus on, or encourage us to look at the long term, because these things do take a while to mature. You know, you cannot change the 4-year graduation rate next year. But I do want to also follow up on his comment. And This is actually from Martin Luther King when he was talking about education. He said, it seems to me that education has a twofold function to perform in the life of a man in society. By the way, everybody was a man back then. You know, they wouldn't talk about men and women. The one is utility and the other is culture. Education must enable a man to become more efficient to achieve with increasing facility legitimate goals of his life. The function of education, therefore, is to teach one to think intensively and to think critically. But education which stops with efficiency may prove the greatest menace to society. The most dangerous criminal may be the man gifted with reason but with no morals.
Thank you. Dr. Brown?
Despite practicing my talk several times, I went long. I'm going to yield my last moment to my colleague to the left.
I just think you deserve higher education to be great in New Mexico.
I want to thank our panel. I think we've hit our 9 o'clock, and I really appreciate all of you being here tonight and being so candid and open and honest. I think we've had a good discussion. We appreciate very much our legislators being here, and thank you to our audience and to KANW, Mark Saavedra. Thank you very much. Good night.